All lines are now bridged.
Great, thank you very much, and hello everyone, and thank you for joining the October High Tech meeting. I'm Mike Berry with ONC, and we are really excited to have you with us today. As a reminder, we welcome your feedback, which can be typed in the chat feature throughout the meeting, or can be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled at approximately 12:30 Eastern Time this afternoon. First, I would like to welcome ONC's executive leadership team to the meeting, and with us today is our national coordinator, Mickey Tripathi, Steve Posnack, our deputy national coordinator, Elise Sweeney-Anthony, the executive director of the Office of Policy, and Avinash Shambag, the executive director of the Office of Technology. I will now call the meeting to order and begin roll call of the HITECH members along with the federal agency representatives of the HITECH. And I'll start with our co-chairs, Aaron Meary.
Good morning.
Denise Webb.
Good morning.
Michael Adcock. James Elsey. Cynthia Fisher. Lisa Fry.
Good morning.
Lisa, I think you might need to put on mute because we're getting an echo. Thank you. Valerie Gray.
Good morning.
Adi Gunlapalli.
Good morning. Thank you.
Stephen Hester.
Good morning.
Ram Iyer. Jim Gerges. John Kansky.
Good morning.
Ken Kamoto.
Good morning.
Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Leslie Leonard. Arian Malik.
Good morning.
Glenn McDonald. Elaine Hunnelt, who is sitting in for Jonathan Nebaker. Elaine? Brett Oliver.
Good morning.
Terry O'Malley.
Good morning.
James Pantelis.
Good morning.
Carolyn Peterson.
Good morning.
Raj Watwani. Michelle Schreiber.
Good morning.
Abby Sears is absent today. Alexis Snyder.
Good morning.
Ram Sharam.
Good morning.
Saksha Termat.
Good morning.
Andrew Truscott.
Good morning.
Cheryl Turney.
Good morning.
And Robert Waugh.
Present. Good morning, everyone.
Great. Thank you very much, everyone. And now please join me in welcoming Mickey Tripathi for his opening remarks. Mickey?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Excellent. Okay. I figured out the technology. Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for joining. I'm really, really excited to be here today because we've got a special meeting focused on TEFCA, the Trusted Exchange Framework and Common Agreement. It's been almost 5 years since passage of the 21st Century Cures Act that called on ONC to develop a trusted exchange framework, including a common agreement among health information networks nationally. When I took office in January, somewhat halting progress was being made on it, and it had been almost 2 years since release of any key artifacts, and no timelines had been set either externally or internally for what would be implemented and when. A key question at that point, of course, was, does it still make sense to move forward with this model? As you know, we've all been engaged in this for a while. After some examination, I believe and very firmly believe, and ONC firmly believes, that the answer is a resounding yes. And why is that, you may ask? Because, you know, we have nationwide networks today. Won't they just take care of it is one question that we get sometimes. The other set of questions we often get is, well, we have FHIR APIs. Won't they make networks obsolete anyway? So, you know, why all the focus on this? Well, let me just, you know, discuss each of those things in turn. One is, you know, we do indeed have networks, and they've made tremendous progress. I mean, I myself was directly involved in them at the local, state, and national levels for, you know, for the last 20 years, really, and can certainly attest to the great work that they've done and they continue to do. I will also say, though, that their progress has slowed due to the difficulties of getting market consensus in a really fragmented market of competitive actors. They've done very well in creating the policy and technical foundation for providers to exchange data for treatment purposes, but last mile implementation remains really thin and really spotty. I think any one of us who goes to get care, has the experience that most frontline providers and staff aren't even aware of these network capabilities by and large, and their organization instinct is still fax, paper, flash drives, and CD-ROMs. And that's the low-hanging fruit. Extending these networks to include other important healthcare stakeholders like individual patients, for example, health insurers, public health agencies, and research safety surveillance has made relatively little material progress due to conflicting competitive pressures of the various healthcare stakeholders and legal regulatory issues that are really difficult to navigate with a market-only process. Now let's just speak about, FHIR APIs for a second and the future relevance of networks. I think that the answer there isn't an or, meaning FHIR APIs or networks. It's an and. It's both, meaning that FHIR APIs are going to exist in the wild, and they will continue to flourish in the wild, and they're going to be great. They already are starting to be great, and they're going to be even greater for focused exchange and richer interoperability patterns and unique data requirements like FHIR hooks and smart and FHIR apps and FHIR questionnaires and, lots of great use cases there that we want to be able to continue to push on and promote. Networks, however, are going to continue to serve the more back-end purpose of high-volume, high-reliability B2B exchange of standardized information. They provide transparent, scalable governance and contracting, clear rules of the road, shared services like security, endpoint directories, record location, a variety of things that networks provide that are different in nature but still equally important. So, we don't know how interoperability is going to unfold over the next 5 years any more than we did 5 years ago, and it's important that we push on all options so that we don't cut off innovation and to preserve a fair and competitive playing field. With all that in mind, we're really excited to finally bring this to reality. And what you're going to see here is the result of considerable refinements to, greatly increase the odds of success. So first, in July, we announced a timeline that hadn't been announced before. TEFCA-backed exchange is going to be available for participation in the first quarter of 2022. That's important for internal accountability to keep us all focused on the government side to meet our obligations and our responsibility to the market. And it's also important for the market to know so that all of you in the market can set your expectations accordingly, can decide what it is you want to do, to make the investments that you want to make as you think about, where you want your network-based interoperability to go. We've more directly aligned TEFCA to complement the market and to help it get past obstacles, but not to replace it or to stifle what's going on in the market today. And, this is sort of everything from explicitly aligning it with HIPAA and applicable law so that we're not creating confusion by creating a separate set of rules, to beginning with the standards used in the market today to meet the market where it is and not expecting, a huge leap forward that can create a considerable gap in, where the market is today and where TEFCA-based exchange might lead us. So we have also, though, included a FHIR roadmap, and that's going to be a part of what we deliver. Previous versions of TEFCA and all of these associated artifacts were completely silent on FHIR. We're now going to include a FHIR roadmap that will set high-level expectations for the incorporation of FHIR-based exchange. Of course, nationwide and state regional HIEs are already on this path, but each is doing it in relative isolation. So there's a lot of activity in each of these, in each of these networks, but it's relatively uncoordinated. And so, forward progress directionally, but not a lot of orchestration or coordination. So what we're hoping is that the FHIR roadmap is going to be the opportunity for us to get nationwide coordination for a full nationwide picture of FHIR-based network exchange. Another aspect of the refinements we've made is we're giving more operational leeway to our private sector nonprofit partner, the Sequoia Project. The federal government has a really, really important role to play in providing a North Star for nationwide interoperability to bring these networks together and have them pointed in the same direction and provide that, sort of degree of consistency across them. And in setting hard policy guardrails that are important to the public interest and ongoing oversight to continue to assert the public interest as we think about nationwide interoperability. But the federal government also has an equally important role to play in getting out of the way in areas where we don't have the expertise, the experience, or the management structures or management agility to provide day-to-day management and day-to-day operational, role for something as fast-moving and continually evolving as network-based exchange in healthcare. Finally, and somewhat more behind the scenes, but equally important, is that we've been working really hard to get federal partner participation, which really could be a critical driver of adoption. I'm pleased to say that we've got dedicated discussions underway with many of our federal partners, including CMS and CDC, for example, and that's just an example. And though I certainly can't promise anything, certainly don't want to promise anything on anyone's behalf there, I will say that we've got a level of, really no kidding, strategic and programmatic interest from those agencies that's unlike anything we've had in the past. So a lot of hope that we've got a lot of things going in the right direction now that can help us all move forward. So we've done a ton of work to get this back on track over the last few months and to fulfill the important goals laid out in the 21st Century Cures Act. And what you're going to see this morning is the fruits of those efforts, which reflect not only hard work by the Sequoia Project and ONC staff, but considerable stakeholder feedback over the last few months and indeed over many years, let alone the last several months, and federal partner input as well. One final point I want to make on TEFCA is that we should recognize that this is going to continue to evolve. And the common agreement that the Square Project is going to describe to you is, and the associated policies and procedures that derive from it are going to have to adapt to changes in the market on an ongoing basis. The most important thing we can do from the federal government side is to set up the very good starting point and then transparent, trustworthy processes to build and adapt from there. So I very much look forward to the discussion. I want to thank in advance the Sequoia Project team. That's, Marianne, Alan, Steve, Kate, Chantal, and very much thank you in advance for your partnership and for the presentation today. One other thing before I leave is I just want to flag a couple of items for your awareness. One, we're really excited to begin our work with the awardees of the Public Health Informatics and Technology Workforce Development Program, where we awarded $73 million to strengthen U.S. public health information technology efforts, improve data collection, COVID-19 data collection, increase representation of underrepresented communities with the public health IT workforce. We did make that announcement of 10 collaborations, minority-serving institutions and collaborations that we're going to be formally kicking off next week. The other thing I just wanted to flag for all of you is I hope all of you saw an important new blog post that came out last Friday about ONC's work on a new initiative called the USCDI Plus. This initiative is developed to support the identification and establishment of domain or program-specific data sets that will operate as extensions to the existing USCDI. It's a service that ONC is providing to our federal partners who have a need to establish, harmonize, and advance the use of interoperable data sets that extend beyond the core data in the USCDI in order to meet agency-specific programmatic requirements. And I'm pleased to announce that CMS and CDC are our first partners, and we've got a ton of great work on the ground going on with both of them right now to get that up and running. And we'll add more domains once we've got the program more firmly established. We'll continue to use similar processes as the USCDI, and we'll certainly leverage the HITAC and the USCDI task force going forward to provide critical input on that. As I said, we're just getting started, so more to come as we figure out the right timing and the right ways to be able to get that engagement. But I assure you that will definitely be a part of this going forward. So let me again thank the RCE team for joining us today, and I really look forward to hearing the HITAC committee's feedback on the key elements of the Common Agreement in QTF. Thanks to the entire community for your important contribution to ONC's work. And let me turn it over now to Erin and Denise for their opening remarks.
Great. Thank you, Mickey, and good morning to the entire committee. We are really looking forward to hearing about all of the good work and the culmination of the work that the RCE has completed. And to have some dialogue on that. And I want to welcome Marianne and Alan and Steve. Thank you for being here today to present to us and give us an opportunity to provide some feedback. Erin, I'll turn it over to you for any remarks.
Absolutely. So good morning, everybody. Thanks very much. Mickey, thank you for those comments. Kudos to the entire ONC team. I think the entire community recognizes the phenomenal pace you guys are going at and some of the work that's being done there. So thank you for that. All the high-tech members of several of you I've interacted with over the past month on numerous different initiatives, kudos to you in your local areas and the work you're doing to really benefit all of healthcare. It's just an amazing, amazing committee. So today is a pretty packed agenda. I know that Denise is going to kind of go through that with you here in a bit, and then we'll sort of do an approval of minutes and whatnot. But Denise, I'll turn it back to you so we can get going on the agenda.
All right. So for the agenda, I mean, we really do have a single focus today, and it is the Trusted Exchange Framework and Common Agreement. And so Mary Ann and her team representing the recognized coordinating entity is going to go over the elements, the key elements of the Common Agreement. And I know many of you all probably participated in a number of meetings. I know I did while I was able to. And she'll talk about that first, and we will have an opportunity to have some discussion and take a very short break, so everybody can grab a coffee or go to the restroom. And then we are going to hear about the key elements of the Qualified Health Information Network Technical Framework, or the QTF, and then have some discussion on that. And, of course, we hope we have comments from our from the public. We'll have time for public comment, and then our final remarks and adjournment. So if we can get started with approval of the minutes, Aaron, if you want to take that.
Let's do it. All right. So if you all have seen the minutes from last meeting, we're going to go ahead and call a vote on approval. May I have a motion, please?
Trust vote moves.
Have a second.
Second, Jim Jordan.
All right. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. And any abstentions? Okay, the minutes are approved from the previous meeting. Denise, before we get going, let me make a quick announcement about the annual report work group, if you would may. So real quick, I want to just give a quick update here. Again, today is really about the phenomenal work the Square Project and others are doing and hearing some of that details. But on the annual report work group, quick updates for this high-tech to know, Drs. Jim Burgess and Dr. Stephen Lane have joined us. We had a phenomenal discussion, I think, last week. All the days are kind of blending for me right now. But it was phenomenal. We went through it. Some good work there. We are firming that up. We continue to discuss any of the gaps and challenges and opportunities for high-tech activities for inclusion. Again, I encourage you to please send us email, let us know if you have thoughts or things are coming up, especially as you are going about your day that you think are relevant for the report. And then we'll be bringing a draft report to this full committee for consideration early in the winter of 22 to really work through the meat and potatoes of this and get it to goal. So just some quick updates for you for the annual report work group. I couldn't do this without my partner in crime, Carolyn Peterson. She's phenomenal, co-chair for the committee, and I thank her, and I thank Michelle and the entire ONC team for the great work they're doing there. So I think you all will be pleased with what you see here in the very near future. Okay, so with that, I guess, Denise, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our first guest here to keep us on time. So we're going to begin by speaking with Mary Ann Yeager and understanding more about what's going on there from the RCE world. So Mary Ann, welcome to the high tech, and look forward to turning the floor to you.
Oh, well, thank you all very much and for inviting us. Here, let me adjust my camera a little bit. Thank you all for the opportunity to share our progress with the high-tech. As you know, there's a lot of work underway. If you go to the next slide, we'll share the requisite disclaimer that we are here presenting information that we've been facilitating through a cooperative agreement with ONC in our role as a recognized coordinating entity, so nothing that we're sharing is really an official position of the government. Go to the next slide. We'll talk a little bit about what we're going to cover today. We're very eager to hear feedback from this very experienced group and are very interested in all stakeholder viewpoints. We would like to cover certain aspects of the common agreement here. There is not really sufficient time to cover all of it. And similarly with the QHIN technical framework, and obviously we really want to, get your insights into this important work and, of course, from all stakeholders. We also shared the elements of the common agreement as a summary of the key terms and the draft eligibility criteria for QHINs, as well as five documents that look at TEFCA from the viewpoint of from various stakeholders. So we will try to be brief in our comments, and so we have ample time for a discussion. So next, I'd like to, I think you all have already introduced the team, but just if you go to the next slide, there we are. Alan Swenson heads up Carry Quality. He's also been on point, not only informing and you know providing great insights into the work in the Common Agreement, but also lead on the QHIN technical framework. And it will be Alan and his team that work with organizations who wish to be QHINs through the application, onboarding, and designation process. We have two expert legal folks on the team, Steve Gravely and Kate Riccobono from the Gravely Group, and they've been on point working with the ONC team and our team on the Common Agreement and the accompanying standard operating procedures, and Chantal Warzola, who's been heading up stakeholder engagement for us. So next, I wanted to do a quick level set on the Cures Act and TEFCA just as, you know, sort of context for those who may not have been following it as intensely. So in the next slide, you know, why do we need the Trusted Exchange Framework and Common Agreement? Well, the TEFCA came about to address a complex ecosystem where organizations today often have to join multiple health information networks to access the information that they need for treatment and other purposes. And TEFCA really aims to simplify this by enabling organizations to select a home network and that they can use that as their connection point to interconnect and exchange information with others who participate in different health information networks. So TEFCA is a government-endorsed approach for network-to-network information sharing, and in that respect, it really provides a unique opportunity for government and the private sector to work closely together to adopt the policies, legal terms, and implementation-level requirements to enable health information networks to interconnect more readily without substantial additional effort. So next, you know, Cures Act became law in December of 2016, and it required the ONC to develop or support Trusted Exchange Framework and Common Agreement. ONC opted to develop the framework with the intent of leveraging existing efforts to advance the aims of the Cures Act, and the Cures Act permits ONC to also support existing frameworks as well. So the timeline Mickey had mentioned on the next slide, there we go. We're, you know, when he was got engaged and was briefed, we really met as a collective team and realized that we have a tremendous opportunity with TEFCA, but time is of the essence in order for us for this effort to have relevance, and realized that there is an opportunity to accelerate it and bring this program to market in Q1 of 2022. So we are really working and getting input right now on the draft of the Common Agreement and the QHIN Technical Framework, which is an implementation guide. We're working very closely, iteratively, with the ONC team to refine those documents. We're actually in the process of enlisting input on the Common Agreement elements. We'll be collecting input, obviously, to through public webinars, as well as through a stakeholder input process through which we're collecting comments through October 21st. And then really, you know, we'll publish or release the first version of the Common Agreement and the QTF in Q1. These are really living documents. Mickey mentioned it, but I really want to emphasize that we know we are going to learn a lot and that there are a lot of nuances that we need, you know, as we get more experience with this particular approach, that we're going to be modifying it over time. So we may not be able to incorporate and deal with every single solitary issue between now and the end of the year, but we'll continue to iterate on it again through an open, transparent governance process. And then, of course, throughout 2022, onboard QHINs, and that hopefully have information being exchanged next year, as soon as next year. So next, you know, really just to reiterate, the goals of TEFCA are to establish a floor for interoperability, to simplify nationwide connectivity, and importantly, provide a mechanism and infrastructure backbone, if you will, for so individuals can more readily gather their own information. So next, the benefits of TEFCA are really, there are many benefits to TEFCA. For consumers, it provides an opportunity to look at and share records across providers, for instance, rather than via each provider portal. Providers and health systems have the ability to get a 360-degree view of patient care, which is crucial for care delivery, care coordination, management of value-based care. And having a single on-ramp or a simplified on-ramp to include public health reporting is, frankly, creates efficiencies as well. For states, programs, and public health, there's richer data creates better health metrics and the potential for more timely and complete reporting and efficiencies in reporting and program management. Payers will be able to look beyond claim data and have a fuller picture of enrollee health to support care management, value-based care, and other initiatives. And beyond that, there are significant system-wide efficiencies and synergies from having full participation in a nationwide exchange platform, and there's really just a public benefit to this. And having a government-endorsed method for information sharing not only engenders trust, but it provides a unifying framework for trusted exchange that can support a multitude of purposes rather than having an approach that's geared just toward treatment. It's multi-purpose, multi-use, multi-use case, extensible over time, and technology agnostic. And so the overall hope is that we will simplify how information is exchanged and continue to evolve as a backbone for the U.S. So if we go next to the value proposition for TEFCA, we have published these. Their fact sheets are now on our RC website. We conducted interviews with more than 100 subject matter experts from 5 different stakeholder communities and really wanted to understand the value proposition, the opportunity for nationwide exchange in a more universal interoperability from their particular perspectives. And you can see here it's from plans, government, public health, healthcare providers, health information networks, and consumers, importantly. So how will TEFCA work? So ONC designated, on the next slide, a private sector organization, the Sequoia Project, to oversee and govern QHIN to QHIN exchange. We serve that role as a recognized coordinating entity. We were designated as such in 2019. And since then, we've been working with ONC to develop the agreement and implementation guide that networks who wish to be designated as TEFCA qualified would adopt. And if they're successful in demonstrating their ability to meet the expectations, they would be qualified health information networks or QHINs. So we facilitate the process for verifying that those who apply function as a QHIN and meet the requirements and designate them as such. And then by becoming a QHIN, QHINs agree to share information with other QHINs according to the common agreement. This is the agreement that the QHIN and the RCE sign. It puts forward the terms and conditions for exchanging information. And by extension, they also agree to apply with the implementation guide, which we call the QHIN technical framework, and that specifies the technical functions and technical requirements. Once QHINs are designated and live, we, as the RCE, oversee QHIN to QHIN exchange to ensure ongoing compliance with the requirements, and then there are certain expectations that QHINs themselves are expected to pass along to organizations or individuals who connect to that QHIN. These are called QHIN participants. And there could be others that connect to those organizations called sub-participants. So examples of participants could be government agencies, HIEs, healthcare providers, health plans, public health. There are sub-participants could be providers or others who connect their HIEs, for instance. And then importantly, individuals would also be able to connect either directly to a HIN or through an app of their or platform of their choice to access their information. So again, next, just to summarize our role, we are working to develop, update, to maintain the common agreement, working to revise and refine the QHIN technical framework, maintain that over time. It's really important for us to convene and get input through public stakeholder feedback meetings. We do those on a monthly basis and have done really a lot of extensive outreach and will continue to do so. And then to operationally identify, monitor, support, the QHIN process and maintain for adjudicating noncompliance and governance all around that. And then we also have to find a way to make this effort sustainable. So that's some background on our work as the RCE and what we're really ramped up to do. I'd like at this point to turn it over to Steve Gravely, who's going to walk you all through elements of the common agreement. So Steve.
Thank you, Marianne. I was trying to get off mute. All right. Well, hello, everyone. Most of you I know, and it's nice to be talking to you again. For those of you who I haven't had the privilege of meeting, I'm Steve Gravely with Gravely Group, legal counsel to Sequoia, and have the immense privilege of leading the team from a contract perspective in terms of the common agreement. So, we're going to walk through this pretty briskly because we want to be able to, have a dialogue with you about your questions. So my apologies if I'm moving fast. Next slide. We like to think of the common agreement as an organic tool. And there are many elements to that organic pool. There's the common agreement itself, which is a contract. But that's really just the tip of the iceberg. The common agreement, like many contracts, tries to clearly express rights and responsibilities of the parties to the common agreement. But then there's a lot more to the relationship and to making all of this work than simply the legally binding contract. And so there are these other extremely important elements that work with the common agreement itself. There are, pardon me, there are standard operating procedures that go into specific detail about a variety of important topics, perhaps security of information, or how does an organization become a QHIN, or mechanics of the governing body, and things like that. Then there is the human technical framework that Alan Swinson will talk about in a few minutes. There is the whole onboarding process from application through evaluation, vetting, and then ultimately designation of the organization as a QHIN. And then in the near future, which is really exciting to be able to say now, but in the near future, in the first quarter of 22, once this exchange framework is operational, there will be operating metrics that will be collected. And those are an important part of the elements because they will allow the RCE and ONC to really evaluate what's happening, how is it happening, and identify any issues that need intervention. And then last but absolutely not least is the governing approach to this entire, what I call an ecosystem. And it's codified, the governance structure is codified in the common agreement and the SOP, but the governing approach really transcends that. And that's why it's an important element, because governance, in our view, governance is essential. To effective governance is essential, I should say, in order to support the evolution and operation of the framework, provide order and stability and predictability, but not bog the network down. And that's a challenging, a challenge sometimes in and of itself. So that's why we list governing approach as an element of the TESCA. Next slide, please. So I just realized my camera wasn't on, and I apologize for that. You were spared looking at me for a few minutes. All right, so let's walk through these elements one by one. The common agreement. Well, that will establish the legal infrastructure for the exchange of information among the participants, the QHINs, their participants, their sub-participants. And that will all be codified in a legal document that every QHIN, Qualified Health Information Network, will sign with the RCE. Right now that's Sequoia, but there will be an RCE, and this will be a two-party agreement between each QHIN and the RCE. And so at a very simplistic level, the common agreement is a contract. And that's really, really important because of all the legal significance that attends, you know, contracts in American common law and statutory law established over the last several hundred years. Now, some provisions of the common agreement are between the RCE and the Shuhin. Other provisions of the common agreement, the Shuhin is required to flow down to its participants, and then they are required to flow those down to their sub-participants. And we anticipate that we will very clearly label the required flow downs in the body of the document, so that there's absolute transparency to everyone around what has to be flowed down by a Shuhin to its participants and then on to their sub-participants. The common agreement will incorporate by reference two other elements, the Shuhin technical framework and the standard operating procedures. So they become part of the body of the common agreement, although they are distinct elements themselves. We do that obviously to assure enforceability and to not have to create multiple repetitive documents, but to leverage what's in the common agreement to allow the RCE to enforce provisions in the technical framework and the SOPs. Not a unique model, a model with which I'm sure every one of you is familiar. As Mary Ann said, and I certainly want to reiterate, this is an iterative process. Mickey indicated that this is something on which ONC has been working for years, something that the RCE and ONC have been working together on for over 2 years. And all along the way, we've emphasized the importance of feedback from all interested parties. And trying to not just sit back and be passive, but to be active in soliciting feedback. And so certainly today, we welcome feedback from the HITAC. Next slide, please. So now what I'm going to do is dive into a few core concepts that are in the common agreement. We have neither the time nor probably is there the need to show a table of contents and work through every single section. That we would be here all day, and I'm sure you guys would appreciate that, but that's not our mission this morning. Our mission instead is to focus on a few core concepts that we want to dialogue with the HITAC about. The first one is cooperation and non-discrimination. And Mickey alluded to this, as did Mary Ann, in describing, so where are we today with our existing infrastructure that supports the exchange of health information. And so the common agreement, I'm not going to comment on that because I'm sure you all have your own view and we've already discussed it earlier. The common agreement intends to very clearly specify what is expected of a Shuhin, its participants, and that participant's sub-participants in order to ensure that everyone's rowing in the same direction, which, you know, sounds simple, but we all know it isn't. We all know it doesn't always happen, you know, by accident. And so how do we do that? How do we take that goal and then translate it into a contract? And so we're proposing to do that by focusing on specific types of activity, making it clear that there's an expectation that a Shuhin and their participants and their sub-participants will timely respond to inquiries. Now, this is not this includes responding to queries for TEFIA information. In other words, the whole, you know, the nugget of gold that a query is seeking to get about me as a patient. I mean, sure, it includes that, but it's much more than that. It includes inquiries about is there a problem on your end? Or Q&A says, I'm experiencing the following, does anyone have any insight? Is it my problem, or is there something going on? And you can imagine an infinite number of variations on that example. Cooperation includes responding to those inquiries, saying to Shuhans, these are important. These are your exchange partners, and these queries deserve priority. Yes, everyone's busy. Yes, everyone is short-staffed. We all get that, but these must be given priority. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen all the time today. On the other side, there's an affirmative obligation to push out information if you're a QHEN or a participant or a sub-participant about problems on your end. And once you become aware of them, to let your peers know that, hey, I'm having a problem. And again, that doesn't always happen today for a variety of reasons. The next part of cooperation is when there are issues, and there certainly will be issues, that QHENs, and on down the line, I'm not going to repeat it every single time, that they're expected to support each other, to provide resources, to provide assistance, to provide information, to make time on the calendar, to support each other in working the problem and resolving the issues. And then last, but certainly not least, something has to be last on every list, but not it's very important, an affirmative obligation to engage in information sharing with your peers about cybersecurity risks. And we could talk for hours just about this topic, but we all understand that threat matrix that continues to evolve. We understand that this information is desirable and sought after. And so the ONC and the RCE envision a very robust cybersecurity information sharing framework that will help to reduce the threat that we all know is there. Now, all right, so those are some expectations about cooperation. Let's now turn it around and look at non-discrimination. And what we're going to say in the common agreement is very clearly that a QHEN and its participants and their sub-participants are going to be prohibited from limiting interoperability with any other QHEN participant, sub-participant, or with any individual in a discriminatory manner. And the agreement will go into some detail describing what that is. The essence here is that you're treating similarly situated organizations or individuals in a different way without a valid reason. And that I know that sounds a little bit like a variation of the golden rule, but that's sort of how we're approaching this idea of non-discrimination. It's not that you won't set limits on certain types of activities, but they have to be done in a consistent, fair, equitable way. There has to be a rational basis for them. There has to, you know, they have to further an acceptable purpose. And that's a concept that the care equality framework has operated for many years and has been a guiding principle of the care equality framework, which has served as a bit of a model for the common agreement. And these are foundational values for what we're doing here. Okay, next slide. Thank you. Okay, next concept, exchange purposes. Every network has to have a set of rules that explains what can you use a network for. That's what exchange purposes are in the common agreement. They go by different names in different networks. We call them exchange purposes. And at this time, we plan to start with six, the six that are in the right-hand column on the slide. Treatment payment, healthcare operations, public health, benefits determination, and what we're calling individual access services. I'm going to unpack these in the next slide, but this is our starting point, and I want to emphasize starting point. The common agreement will specifically recognize the ability to add additional exchange purposes over time through the change management process that is addressed in the common agreement and a standard operating procedure. And the expectation is that there will be other exchange purposes in the future. And that we envision that process as both a bottom-up and a top-down process, meaning that the stakeholder community writ large that is involved in exchange will have suggestions and ideas, requests about new exchange purposes. But ONC as well, being at the forefront of advancing interoperability, will also have ideas and suggestions for additional exchange purposes. And those are not mutually exclusive by any means. And so we're looking at this very holistically as a bottom-up, top-down dynamic that will ultimately, at least I think, ultimately lead to additional exchange purposes. Now, this last bullet is really important. QHINs will be required under the common agreement to support all exchange purposes. That is absolutely not the case today. And I'm not saying that in a critical or derogatory way at all. We simply know that there are many networks that are treatment only. There are many other networks that purport to support a number of exchange purposes, but are de facto exchange only. The common agreement will require, as a term of the contract, that QHINs must support all exchange purposes. And you know, that's a real advancement in elevation, however you want to describe it. This is a great example where ONC is using the common agreement to advance interoperability. Next slide. So let's unpack these exchange purposes real quickly. Treatment, payment, and healthcare operations, those are generally going to map the HIPAA privacy rule definitions. I say generally because obviously the HIPAA privacy rule applies to covered entities and their business associates. We're leveraging HIPAA to a large extent, but we're making it clear that the definitions and other provisions of the privacy rule and the security rule apply not only to covered entities and business associates, but also to every QHIN participant and sub-participant, whether they are a covered entity under HIPAA or a business associate or not. So we're adopting these definitions and requirements and then having them apply in most cases to everyone in the ecosystem. Public health exchange purpose, again, looks to HIPAA for the definition of public health authority, which, as you know, is extremely broad. It includes both governmental, the federal, state, local, tribal, governmental instrumentalities, agencies, or even contractors acting under the authority of the government. So a very broad definition. And this exchange purpose includes requests for uses and disclosures of information by public health authorities. Excuse me. Benefits determination is similarly broad. It supports any government agency that is seeking information in order to make some type of determination as to whether a person qualifies for benefits. Social Security Administration is the go-to example, but absolutely not. It doesn't end there. So that's another very broad exchange purpose. The other thing that is a bit different with the common agreement is that it is anticipating the proliferation of consumer-facing applications, and Mickey alluded to this. We're already seeing it, and I think we all agree we'll continue to see it. these apps helping individuals obtain access to their information, use their information, decide how to disclose their information. And we're calling this individual access services. That's the exchange purpose that we're calling it. And so this exchange purpose will support individuals obtaining access through a consumer-facing app or some other type of platform. We're trying to be as broad as we can there to obtain their own information to the extent that that's permitted by applicable law from anyone in the network. So that's a really exciting exchange purpose. And now, one, and we're going to unpack IIS in a minute, one wrinkle about that, and we'll walk through this in a second. There are some exceptions. Remember a moment ago, I said that QHIN's participants and sub-participants had to support every exchange purpose. And that is a true statement. But for IIS, there are some exceptions, and we'll unpack those in a couple of slides. Next slide, please. All right, let's talk about privacy. And to avoid confusion, I have a privacy slide and a security slide that talk about the entire ecosystem. But then when we get to individual access services, you'll see privacy and security slides that build on these two. So I wanted to unpack that now. But this is for everybody. So we anticipate that most of the connected entities, maybe not QHINs, but certainly participants or sub-participants, are likely going to be either covered entities or business associates of covered entities, and therefore they're already in compliance with the HIPAA privacy and security requirements. That's a working assumption. But we're not relying upon that. The common agreement then says that for if you're a healthcare provider that is not subject to HIPAA because you're not engaged in standard transactions, and there certainly are some out there today, then you are expected to protect TEFCA information, TI, TEFCA information, that is individually identifiable the same way that a HIPAA-covered entity would protect EPHI. So in other words, we're not saying that you're subject to HIPAA. We don't have that authority. We're saying that as a matter of contract, you will treat TEFCA information the following way. And the following way is exactly the way HIPAA-covered entities or business associates treat EPHI. And that's a perfectly accepted, you know, legal mechanism. It's enforceable, and that'll be what non-HIPAA healthcare providers are expected to do. The other question is, what about other non-HIPAA entities? Organizations that aren't healthcare providers, that aren't subject to HIPAA, IIS providers come to mind, of course, but there are others. You know, how should they protect the privacy of TEFCA? And, you know, our plan is to, in most cases, continue to apply the privacy rule paradigm. IIS is a bit of a special case, which we'll talk about, but in most cases, apply the privacy rule paradigm to these non-HIPAA entities. We expect to have a section of the common agreement that will be very granular, very specific, based on the assumption that if you're a non-HIPAA entity, you may not be very familiar with the privacy rule. And so saying that you're subject to the privacy rule might not be good enough. We probably need to tell you, here are the provisions that you're subject to, and here is where to find them. A little bit of breadcrumb, but probably not too much detail, probably necessary detail. Okay, next slide. So how about security? Well, QHINs, and this is where we are intentionally differentiating between QHINs on the one hand and their participants and sub-participants on the other. QHINs are being held, will be held to a really high bar. A couple of elements of that bar, but certainly not all of them, is a requirement that every QHIN have third-party certification by an industry-recognized cybersecurity framework. It should be HITRUST. It should be someone else. But it's a third-party certification that is recognized as an authority on this. In addition to that, QHINs must undergo annual security assessments. That goes beyond your certification. For those of you who are certified, you know that typically certification requires, HITRUST certification requires not annual assessments, but biannual or triannual. We're layering on top a requirement for annual assessments. And there are some other requirements. They have to have a chief information security officer. They have to also do other types of activities in their reporting requirements. So QHINs are being held to a high bar. There are also specific flowdowns to participants and sub-participants, which establish as a minimum floor that all participants and sub-participants must comply with the HIPAA security rule, whether you're a covered entity or a business associate or not. So that is, again, a contractual standard where we are leveraging the security rule very intentionally. We also plan to have pretty strict security incident notifications involving QHIN to QHIN exchange. And again, it doesn't matter whether you're subject to the breach notification rule under HIPAA or not, you will be subject contractually to these security incident notifications. They will, again, if you think about the common agreement, it's an agreement between the RCE and the QHIN. So it's a two-party agreement. But in that two-party agreement, we are imposing obligations on the QHIN to report to the RCE, also to report to their fellow QHINs with whom they don't have a contract, but it's a term of the contract with the RCE that they report notifications to their fellow QHINs. And then there are also flowdown provisions to that QHIN's participants and sub-participants. We've really spent a lot of time thinking about this in an effort to try to avoid duplication of existing notification requirements and not to create conflicts between what someone already has to do and what we're asking them to do under the common agreement. And then the RCE will stand up and support a cybersecurity council that is composed of representatives from the participating QHINs, as well as the RCE CISO and other RCE representatives. And that council will focus exclusively on cybersecurity issues that affect the network. And so that's part of the ongoing infrastructure. Next slide, please. Now I want to pivot to what can QHINs, participants, and sub-participants do with the interoperability. And we frame this by looking at types of activity, requests, uses, disclosures, and responses. So requests will be transmitted by the QHINs connectivity services that it maintains with its participants and sub-participants. And the QHIN is required to transmit that request in a manner that is consistent with the QTF that Alan will talk about here in a moment. That's pretty pretty standard, I think. Now, we are putting limits, though, on who can make certain types of requests. For example, if you're going to transmit a request for treatment, that request has to be made by someone who is authorized to engage in treatment. I couldn't initiate a query for treatment. And so it's a simplistic but accurate example of a more complicated idea that we're not, you know, we are putting controls on how requests are initiated because they have to tie to the requester's underlying ability to support that request. Anyway, I think this is something that's, you know, pretty commonly known today and seems to work more or less. Now, when we think about uses and disclosures, and those are the HIPAA framework terms, right? So use relates to the internal use of tech information by a human or a participant or a sub-participant. Disclosure, obviously, is sharing that with someone else. And so that's how we're using those terms. The use and disclosure of tech information by a human, participant, sub-participant will adhere to the Common Agreement privacy and security requirements, as well as any privacy notices that either HIPAA requires, state law requires, federal law requires, tribal law requires. And so those are cumulative, not mutually exclusive. So QHIN's participants and sub-participants are permitted to use TEFCA information. They are permitted to disclose TEFCA information, but they must do so in accordance with the Common Agreement and the privacy and security requirements that we just talked about, as well as any other applicable law, specifically required privacy notices, but any other applicable law. So then responses is a little bit more complex, I guess. The general rule is that a QHIN or its participants and sub-participants will be required to respond to a request for certain types of health information for any exchange purpose. So what does that mean? Well, if providing the requested information would violate applicable law, that should be federal, state, tribal, local in some cases, and not just statutory but regulatory as well. If providing that information would cause a human participant or sub-participant to violate applicable law, then they're not required to do that, of course. In addition, there are six specific exceptions to this duty to respond, if you will, where a response is permitted but not contractually required. And those include a public health agency is permitted to respond to a request for TEFCA information, but it's not required to. An individual access services provider, an app or a platform that supports individual consumer, as it's sometimes referred to, access to their information. If they receive a request, they're permitted to respond to that request, assuming they have the requisite authority from their individual customer whose information is being disclosed. They're permitted to respond, but they're not required to. So, and there are six, let's go to the next slide. There are six specific exceptions to this broad duty to respond rule. And I've highlighted the two that we think are the most noteworthy. All right, now let's pivot again, and I hope I'm not making your head spin. I'm also trying to be respectful of the time. We want to pivot now to how do you become a human? So the common agreement will articulate five specific criteria. At least that's our current thinking, five specific criteria that one must meet in order to be designated by the RCE as a human. And then there will be a standard operating procedure that will talk about the entire process from application to designation. And part of that will be the eligibility criteria unpacked. So again, you're all familiar with this. A contract says you must do the following, 1, 2, 3. More details in the attached. Sometimes the attached is an exhibit. Sometimes the attached is a terms of use. Sometimes the attached is a user manual. In our case, the attached would be standard operating procedures, where we will unpack in great detail what do these mean. And I'm going to walk through these real quickly. So a human has to meet these criteria as a threshold matter in order to be designated. And but then it doesn't stop there. The human has to report to the RCE on an ongoing basis about the about how it's meeting its obligations. And so when we're looking at someone who wants to become a human, the RCE has to evaluate, is this organization capable of supporting the high expectations and legal requirements in the common agreement, the SOPs, and the QTF? And part of that has to do with what are they doing now? And part of that has to do with what is their track record of doing these things in the past? And so what we're thinking about doing is you have to demonstrate that you have the capability to support the exchange purposes. You also have to show that you have a track record over the past 12 months of having engaged in substantially similar activities so that the RCE can see, oh, yes, you can actually do this. I'm going to pause. I see Aaron has popped up on the screen. Hopefully I haven't done anything bad.
No, you've done a great job, and it's a very complicated and multifaceted entity and setup and so forth. So I really appreciate it. I do want to keep it to time. And I know that there's several slides left. Maybe we could hit the real high level, 50,000 foot on each of them, and then come back after to make sure we stay the calendar. Will that work for you?
Absolutely, Aaron. Thank you. I'm sorry.
All right, go for it, Steve. No, it's quite all right.
I'm great. I get a little carried away. All right, next slide. All right, so these are the five criteria. And so these two, you must be a U.S. entity. That's a defined term. And you must be able to exchange required information. And that's the, are you able to do it? Let's go to the next slide. This is a little more complicated, but this is what I was talking about, where you have to demonstrate that you can do this, right? And we picked the 12 calendar months as a marker. No magic in that. But then we've also indicated that the RC can consider other evidence. And because we don't want to cheat people out unfairly. And so we have the ability to designate someone on a provisional basis. Maybe they've been doing something for 8 months or 9 months. So that's what this very long paragraph says. Next slide. Then the applicant has to show that they have the resources in place, not just the technology, but also the personnel, the governance, the legal and other infrastructure necessary to support a high-volume, high-quality network. And then last but not least, they have the ability, functionally and technically, to comply with the QTF, which Alan's going to unpack. Okay, next slide. Real quick, on insurance, this is something we're discussing real time with ONC and others. We are going to require some evidence that a shoe-in have either insurance or a sufficient reserves to cover the liability. Next slide. I'm going to defer this for Alan. Let's go to the next slide. We've already talked about that, probably more than I should have. Let's just skip on. Again, I did mention there were some additional privacy and security requirements. If we have time, we can unpack that. Next slide. Next slide. All right, fees. I believe this is my last one. We in ONC are very committed to not erecting barriers to exchange, and therefore shoe hens will not be able to charge fees to other shoe hens to exchange information. Now, shoe hens can charge their own customers fees. We're not trying to blow up, an economic system, but they aren't able to charge other shoe hens fees to exchange information. With that, I think that's it for me. Next slide. And again, my apologies to the group and to Alan. I will now stand down.
No, all good. I appreciate that. All right. Let's see here. So that's the last slide for the common agreement. Is there any other – no, it's time for Q&A, I believe. So with that, HITECH members, I know that we were just a couple of minutes over, but I appreciate Steve doing that expedited review at the very end. Hopefully you folks read ahead, and we can now open up for questions. I would encourage you to please use the hand raise function as we do for these things, and then we can get into it. All right. So first up, I see Mr. John Kansky.
Thanks, Aaron. Can Steve comment on what constrains the reuse of data accumulated or received through TEFCA transactions? What constrains QHINs, IAS providers, or participants in terms of reuse of TEFCA data? Thank you.
Steve, you may be unmuted. You may be mute, Steve.
Sorry, Aaron. I was.
No worries.
John,
go
for it. That would be applicable law, John. Whatever that entity is subject to. And then if IAS providers, they're going to have terms of use for their customers that probably restrict them as well. But the construct really is applicable law.
That is to say, if they get data and it's legal for them to use the data for that purpose and they haven't agreed to constrain it otherwise in a contract, they can reuse the data.
Yeah, that would be accurate. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. All right, next in queue, Arian Malik, before.
All right, I just wanted to jump in and remind people that in most cases, a QHIN is going to be a BAA. There are obviously cases of non-HIPAA covered entities, but typically your typical QHIN is going to also be a business associate covered and constrained by a BAA that obligates them to data use under the business associate agreement. I think that's the right balance of law. That the QHIN operates on behalf of the participants that it connects. I think we've gotten ourselves into trouble by trying to apply other participants' obligations on all of the participants in the network. And in this case, I think we're setting an appropriate balance. I also want to remind, I saw a number of comments go through the chat in the FOSSA chat. I want to remind people that constraining behavior through contract law is what makes the world go round. The cases where federal enforcement is required, other than the usual remedies that are associated with contract law, the cases where there are federal agencies who directly apply enforcement, such as OCR or FTC, are few and far between. And in almost all cases, it's contract law that makes the world go round. And so grounding legal agreements in contract law is a very appropriate thing to be doing. And then the notion of a flow-down term is a very common framework in health information exchange, in broad health information exchange networks. And almost every participant in the U.S. healthcare system is subject to a flow-down term of some shape or form, whether it's for e-prescribing or clearinghouses or participation in a national network or an HIE, and it seems to just work. So just want to commend the work in grounding, just taking advantage of all of the constructs that we've worked out over the literal decades of doing this to put together a pretty pragmatic contractual framework for information exchange. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next in queue is Mr. Jim Durgis.
Yeah, hey, thank you so much for the presentation. That was really informative and appreciate your taking the time. I had three questions I put in the post, but I'm just going to ask one verbally here. We understand that, you know, the six exchange purposes that govern instances of health exchange, we kind of get that. How does that work? Like, for example, if somebody, a participant or somebody tries to make a request, how does the fulfiller of the request, the key hint or others, is there information requirements that validate the purpose of the request? Or is that just sort of, how is that enforced and executed upon?
Thanks, Jim. Great question, which I'm going to defer to Alan about, or Marianne, because that type of thing is addressed in this UTF, I believe.
Well, I'll start, and then Alan maybe can weigh in. So it's part of the assertions that accompany the message, and then the agreement itself, I think, requires accurate assertions. So, and I don't know, Alan, do you want to just defer that to the QTF discussion or address it now?
Yeah, I mean, we can certainly get into more of the details when we get into some of the QTF stuff, but it is, there's the contractual piece, defining the exchange purposes, as Steve explained, and so you're required to use the exchange purpose as appropriate to the request. And then within the actual message itself, there is an assertion, a SAML assertion, that indicates who the request is from, details of the request, including that exchange purpose, to allow the responding side to make an appropriate determination based on those details of what they will respond with.
And those will be published, those detailed requirements for each of the six regions? What data is required?
Yes, those are detailed as the definitions of each exchange purpose. So those are defined in the common agreement.
And for clarity, this is Aaron, I just want to make sure those permissible type activities, also I would take it there's going to be the other side of it, which is common impermissible activities, aka data harvesting and other things, correct? Yeah, so you'll be very clear and explicit about that.
The prohibited purposes are not laid out.
Go ahead, Marianne. Sorry.
Well, go ahead. No, go ahead. I mean, there is multifaceted. I'll let you take this one.
Well, I mean, the simple answer, but it's not really simple, is that instead of listing what you can't use the interoperability for, we identify what you can use it for, and that's exchange purposes in conformance with the SOPs and QTF. So if it's not a permitted exchange purpose, then you cannot do it. And so I think, again, that's fairly typical. I'll stop there.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that. I would give some credit to ONC here as they put out their FAQs recently around information blocking, which helped clear a lot of questions that were very common in the marketplace with some very plain English. So I would encourage you to think about doing something similar. I agree it's not exhaustive, and you can't quite clearly think of every permissible way somebody may try to do something, you know, we haven't thought of before, so I understand that. But just some of the common plain English items may get us over the line in terms of adoption and any hesitations around that. So just a food for thought. That was a good question. Okay, next in queue, I see Sasha Tremont.
Thanks. This is Sasha. I was wondering, as we expand from some of the more commonly adopted purposes to all of the proposed ones, what will be the plan for making sure that we have the supporting tools ready, like implementation guides, so that the rollout and implementation of some of the purposes that might be less common across the industry can be efficient?
Well, this is Mary, and I think that the initial version of the QTF does not lay out the specifics around all of that. We are hearing from stakeholders that there is, would be an interest and value in unpacking that further. And so I'll defer to Alan, since that's really related to the QTF itself and the other exchange purposes, Alan.
Yeah, I mean, we'll definitely talk more about that in the QTF, but in general, yes, the QTF itself is the implementation guide that defines the constraints for how to use any of the connectivity services for exchange. It does not necessarily get into specifics of differences from one exchange purpose to another, and so there may be additional work there as things are needed, if needed. But it is, you know, as Steve explained, it's required that each of the exchange purposes are essentially equal in required response following the implementation guide conformance requirements of the QTF.
Okay. All right. So then next in queue, I see Andy Truscott and then John Kansky. So Andy?
Thank you very much. Thank you, team. It's been a very informative presentation. Thank you very much for the obvious level of effort that you've been putting into the thinking and for articulating it moderately succinctly what's a fairly complicated series of issues. I've got 4 points to make. Some of these are kind of questions and a couple of them are more statements. The first is, I thought I just heard when we were talking about technical expressions around exceptions that this would be a SAML assertion as opposed to anything in OAuth, et cetera. Was that correct? And if that was correct, have we considered a broader set of implementations to enable more Android integration with existing HIEs and exchanges, et cetera?
That is correct. Again, we'll get into some of those further details in the QTF review, but all of the exchange in initial version 1 are IHE profiles using SAML assertions. OAuth would come in as we move to FHIR in a future version.
Okay, so that would be interesting to hear the ONC feedback if we're constraining to only IHE profiles. That would be very interesting to hear a bit more detail around that. Secondly, the whitelisting approach, I personally believe that blacklisting as well would be pragmatic and sensible and would provide more direct instruction and clarification around permissive uses. Thirdly, there needs to be some kind of implementation path here for existing exchanges. Not everybody uses IHE profiles to that particular point you just made. And that incremental approach, how are we going to support that? How are we going to support, I think is the best way, both financially, but also with, as Sasha was just saying, implementation guides, et cetera. Some better understanding around that, I think, would be very useful. Certainly, some of the implications of the mandates, which you're defining here, appear to actually fundamentally change some of the technical characteristics of some of the exchanges to actually make them more processors of data. And understanding actually the intended and unintended consequences of that, I think, will be particularly useful. And lastly, I think there's a lot of lessons to learn, both from previous activity here in the US, but also with global activity. And I think some of the constraints that we seem to be placing upon this and the mandates up front, we could usefully learn from how that has promoted or prevented adoption elsewhere. Thanks very much again.
Yeah, and I'll just say, this is Alan, the third point there that you raised we'll definitely get into in review of the QTF, so I don't think we need to say anything further on that one. We will look at where the IHE profiles are specifically required and other forms of connectivity that may use be used down the chain. We'll get into that in the QTF review.
Wonderful, wonderful. I like Andy's idea of learning from our global partners. That's an excellent suggestion there. All right, next in queue, Mr. John Kansky.
Thanks, Aaron. I think this is the best place to make this comment, and I wanted to be clear that I think the RCE is doing a great job, and that explanation was super helpful. So this comment is, I guess, directed at the ONC. I wanted to draw some attention to something that I don't hear us talking a lot about, going all the way back to 21st century cures and the instruction to avoid disruption of existing exchange. My perspective is that, you know, my organization and other HIEs nationally are expecting to adapt to this and to find our place in the new ecosystem. However, I did want to share that early empirical feedback I'm getting from our customers or from the field is that TEFCA, my version, puts its thumb on the scale strongly in favor of EHR-supported networks over agnostic health information exchanges. So I would ask ONC to consider gathering some input from the field specifically to make sure that the rollout and rules of TEFCA are in compliance with that aspect of 21st century cures. Thanks.
Good point, John. And I can tell you that on the provider side, we absolutely do get a lot of interesting noise from the field that has conflicting signals. So I think that's a very relevant and salient point to look at and get more data and evidence to the point of it. Hopefully, combined with what the Good Work Sequoia Project's doing and others are doing, folks are better educated about what's required, right? And we can chalk it up to misinformation or miseducation on the rollout. Okay, we've got about 4 minutes left to break. Any other questions, any hands, any other comments folks want to ask? Now, Mary Ann, maybe this one's for you. I'll ask it because it's been on the top of my mind. You alluded to it a little earlier, and I think it's a wonderful job that Sequoia does. You did an information blocking boot camp that was really helpful and really widely acclaimed across the industry. You mentioned something about a certification process here as well and other training. Is there anything further you are able to speak towards in terms of general education, either on the provider side or on the potential cooperative partner side?
You mean around TEFCA specifically, education?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Yes. So we have a stakeholder engagement and education strategy that we're working on in preparation for the rollout, and that would include, public sessions, of course, and then targeted by the stakeholder group. A particular note is the importance of having clarity for consumers in terms of what this means for them and what this enables them to do in terms of their information. And so we, as part of our planned activities, develop a strategy again with ONC. So we will be doing a lot of education. I anticipate there will probably be some technical assistance we'll have to provide, you know, particularly for networks that want to go through the onboarding process. There'll be probably pretty rigorous vetting of the applicants themselves in terms of making sure that they have the characteristics and can meet the criteria, particularly around governance, which is really important, and that they have the capabilities to support that, and then possibly, likely, technical testing. But yes, I mean, stakeholder education on this is going to be key for success, and it's really beyond having QHINs on board, but that there's interest in participating in this method of exchange, so for sure.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I like the fact that patient education, I'm sure we have some phenomenal patient advocates on the high tech. I'm sure that made them perk up and listen in closely. So that's really good. Focus on making sure the consumer is educated on how to access your information is important. So that's good. Okay. So high tech, I think we are at time for break. Marianne, Steve, I want to applaud both of you. That was a lot of information to get through in a little over an hour. So thank you for doing that. And we definitely look forward to the second half of the presentation here. So high tech members, you have until 11:35 Eastern time. It's a little bit over 5 minutes, maybe five minutes straight up now. So go stretch, go grab a water, and we'll see you back in 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. lines are now bridged.
Great. Thank you very much. And welcome back from our very short break to the October HITACH meeting. And I will turn it over right away to Aaron and Denise to kick us off for the second portion of the RCE's presentation today. Aaron, Denise?
Thank you, Mary. Sure. All right, so we're going to launch into the second half of the presentation from the RCE, and they're going to cover the QHIN technical framework. And I think I'm turning over the mic to Alan, I believe. Take it away, Alan.
Alan, maybe I'll mute if you were talking.
Well, there we go. After a year and a half of this, you think we'd figure out how to not double mute everything. So hopefully you can hear me now.
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. So thanks, everybody. We're going to jump into the QHIN technical framework, the QTF. I think most acronyms that we'll use have been defined at this point, but I'll try to define any as they come up, at least the first time. I know we like to use a lot of acronyms. QTF being one of my favorite kinds of acronyms. It's an acronym embedded within another acronym. So to know what QTF means, you have to know what QHIN means. Again, that's the QHIN, are the Qualified Health Information Networks. And it's important, the name here, again, we'll get into some of the further details, but this is the QHIN technical framework. And if we jump to the next slide here, we'll look at some of the what's included in here. And this is really, getting back to one of the earlier questions, this is the implementation guide for those who are familiar with Cary Quality's query-based document exchange implementation guide. This will feel very similar to you with some additional pieces, as we'll get into some of the additional forms of exchange that this also includes. But this details the technical specifications and other requirements specifically for QHINs to accomplish exchange. So that's, again, that's important. Getting back to some of the earlier questions about the IHE profiles and where things apply, who things apply to, et cetera, this really is about QHINs and what QHINs are required to do. There are a few technical requirements that do flow down to participants and sub-participants, such as some of the auditing requirements and handling of patient demographics and returned data and things like that. But for the most part, the QHIN technical framework defines and is specifically limited to defining requirements to the QHINs. So let's jump into some of, if we jump to the next slide here, some of what is included in that. So the QHIN technical framework, the goal is really to build from current capabilities that exist in the industry today. Starting with known standards that are widely used, and then looking toward the future of additional approaches. That gets into, again, one of the previous questions around current use of IHE profiles, some of the things that we will talk about here in a few slides coming in the future with FHIR-based exchange. But we're really starting from standards that are widely used in networks and frameworks today, specifically for, there on the left, patient discovery, document query, and message delivery are the main flows that we will be talking about here. There are a number of functions and technology that are outlined. Each of the bullets here, if you had a chance to review the QTF, it's a quick, exciting read. If you haven't read it yet, I definitely recommend you go take a look at it. I know many of you did submit feedback, so thank you for having taken a look at that already. But each of the bullets here lines up with sections throughout the QTF, each of these having specific constraints and conformance statements throughout them, defining how all of these are used, you know, certificates and handling of mutual TLS communication between servers for authentication, et cetera. Authorization and exchange purposes, again, gets back to some of the definitions of those exchange purposes are contained in the common agreement itself, but the QTF then it puts requirements around how those are asserted. Again, that's looking at the SAML token that's in the actual IHE profile message. There are a few pieces here that I do want to specifically spend a minute talking about. We didn't get into a whole lot of the discussion previously with directory services. The directory services has really two pieces here. There is the contractual piece, and then there are some of the technical requirements, technical pieces. So the contractual piece that we largely skipped over in discussion of the common agreement really just gets into the requirements for handling of the directory service, what you're allowed to do with the information that comes from the directory, prohibiting it being used for marketing purposes, with some exceptions. And so there are some details around confidentiality of information that is contained within the RCE directory service. That directory ultimately is, I guess on the technical side, what we're talking about here is a FHIR R4 organization and endpoint directory. Again, for those familiar with the Carry Quality framework today, this will feel very familiar to what you already know and use there. But this will define the relationship between QHINs, their participants, their sub-participants, sub-sub-participants, all the way down the chain, including connectivity endpoint information, details about organizations that are participating, and the OIDs, home community IDs, et cetera, so that a request can be both targeted to a specific organization where information needs to be from and be able to chain that up to who the QHIN is, as well as being able to audit who a request specifically came from when you are responding to a request from someone else. So there would be multiple ways to initiate a query. Again, we'll get into that a little bit here in the actual flow in a couple of slides. But the directory allows for both targeting to a QHIN, to multiple QHINs, or even to participants and sub-participants within a QHIN based on the structure of those QHINs and how that is defined and chained together within the directory. Patient identity resolution is a topic that also has some requirements in the QTS. I know that is a topic of discussion that has been had here in the HITACH previously. There are many national discussions going on as well around patient identity resolution, demographics-based matching. There are requirements around demographic information that must be sent when sending a request in order to ensure that the responding side has the appropriate ability to make a patient match based on the demographic information that is included in the request that comes across to them. We do not today define a baseline for patient matching algorithms. There is not an industry standard for that today, though there are a number of efforts going on that front, including patient matching, demographics-based matching work group through Carry Quality that is ongoing currently, looking for recommendations. So I know this is a topic that has come up in many of the past webinars, and I believe is something we likely would be looking at future improvements, coordination, work with the community on how to improve some of the demographics-based patient matching. Again, there are some specific constraints around information that must be sent in order to ensure the best matching possible, but really the matching is then left to the responding organization and their patient matching algorithms to make an appropriate determination if they know the patient that information is being requested for. I think, so there, again, I mentioned auditing does have some flow downs. Participants and sub-participants have some requirements that flow down as well for auditing. And let's move on to the next slide here. So again, I mentioned there are multiple pieces to the exchange here. Really, it's broken down into two exchange modalities, those exchange modalities being query and message delivery. Those are sometimes referred to as push and pull in the industry. They often are used complementary to each other, query being the ability to ask for information. I'm seeing a patient for the first time and I need to go get information from wherever it is at, or patient was recently discharged from the hospital, I need to go get additional discharge information from the hospital. I can send a query and ask for specific information to be returned. Message delivery is a proactive push of information. I am sending a referral or I'm discharging a patient from the hospital and need to send discharge information, sending an electronic case report for public health, et cetera, where I am proactively sending information that I know is going to be needed rather than waiting for the other side to come ask for it. The two are, again, widely used in the industry together today, and so it makes a lot of sense to include both of them together as the initial phase of TESCA-based exchange. So let's jump to the next slide, and this gets into a bit of the diagram of the exchange and also shows in the middle here some of the actual exchange profiles that we are requiring. Now, the important point here, again, is that that middle column that shows IHE, XCPD, XCA query, XCA retrieve, and then XCDR for the four steps of exchange or the four flows or pieces of the exchange, those are only required QHIN to QHIN. So what the QTF defines is the method that QHINs communicate between each other to ensure that we have consistency from one QHIN to another, and that the QHINs are able to successfully communicate. For the technical connectivity steps, the QTF does not define how a QHIN must communicate with its participants or participants with their sub-participants, et cetera, on down the chain. So a participant who is connected to their QHIN could be leveraging really any other method of connectivity. It could be, you know, an XDS connection. It could be proprietary APIs. Could even be FHIR APIs. It could be any other number of standards that could be used. And so that goes back to one of the previous questions around just what is already supported and other methods of exchange. The IHE profiles that are required here are QHIN to QHIN. Anything else could really be used QHINs down the line. And I expect that that'll probably be a point of differentiation between QHINs. It's very likely that there will be some QHINs that say, you know, we're just going to make this easy and require that our participants send messages to us with XCPD, XCA, and XCDR so that we don't have to translate anything. We just pass the message through. There will certainly be other QHINs who will expect to be connecting the types of participants who don't support those standards today. And they may have a set of proprietary APIs or may use, again, other industry standards. If this were like an HIE, for example, that's using other industry standards already, they can continue to use whatever other method down to their participants, and then the QHIN would be responsible for handling the translation from whatever method of connectivity their participants got the message up to the QHIN to the appropriate XCPD, XCA, or XCDR message when sending it across to the other QHIN. So the way that these flows work, I think, again, most are probably familiar with both of these flows, at least to some extent. But starting with the query is a three-step process. So it starts on the left side of the diagram here with the query source. Requesting information from someone who exists in the directory. That message iterates up through any number of hops, sub-participant to participant up to QHIN, again using really any method of connectivity as allowed by each hop along the chain, gets up to the QHIN, and the QHIN would convert that initial message, this is a patient discovery, to an XCPD. So this is requesting, do you know this patient based on the provided demographics? That query could be sent as a targeted query if the query source knows specifically who they need information from. That could be targeted in the directory to a specific organization to send the request to. If this is, you know, an emergency room visit and don't know where the patient has information, a PCP seeing patient for the first time and wants to just gather anything that's available outside, that could be more of a broad query where the QHIN would send the query on to all other QHINs and ask each QHIN if they know the patient. So both of those methods of targeting or more broadcast type query would both be allowed. The QHIN leveraging information in the directory to determine the appropriate route to send those. The receiving QHIN at this point with the patient discovery query is going to determine if they know who the patient is based on a few potential options. Again, these are detailed in the QTF for those who have taken a look. The QHIN, I would expect that many will have either a record locator service or a master patient index at the QHIN level to be able to determine if and which of their participants or sub-participants know the patient, because the QHIN already knows that. It would also be allowed for the QHIN to federate that query down to their participants and down the chain. If the QHIN doesn't know who the patients are, asking each participant or potentially sub-participant to make that determination on their own and return the response back up to the QHIN, who would then aggregate those responses to pass back to the initiating QHIN and down the chain back to the query source. Once a patient match has been found, the response to that query is either, no, I don't know who this patient is, or yes, I do, and here's the patient's identifier. The follow-up query is the FCA query for this patient identifier that the query source knows what documents are available for this patient. The response to that comes back as, here is a list of available documents. The subsequent query is the FCA retrieve, where for one or more documents in the provided list, I would like to retrieve, download those specific documents. So those three steps usually are pretty just back to back to back in many scenarios for the query flow. The message delivery flow is the final listed on the slide here. That is the XCDR standard. Again, the important piece is that XCDR is what's required QHIN to QHIN. This could be an XDSB push, an ITI 41 connection. It could be even other forms of direct messaging or proprietary APIs, FHIR, et cetera, to get from the initiating source, the message source, up to their QHIN. QHIN converts it to an IHEX CDR message to the responding QHIN, who then passes it down the chain to the ultimate responding source, the end destination. In that one, there is an acknowledgement that comes back. But otherwise, it is a one-step process. Back to one of the questions from the previous discussion. In the query flow, it's left to the responding source to determine the appropriate response to each query. So along this whole chain, information from the query source is sent along with the SAML token of the request, so that the responding source can determine from the directory who is this organization, who is the user or the system that initiated the query, what is the purpose for the request, looking at the exchange purposes. And using that information, the responding source can make an appropriate determination of whether they are allowed to respond with information, you know, or if there are additional consent or authorization requirements that are needed, and what information is appropriate to respond with. In the case that additional information or consent information specifically is needed, there is the ability detailed in the QTF for the responding source or for the query source even to assert a consent that has been collected or that is needed. So the query source could assert in their query that they do have an additional patient consent form on file that is known as an instance access consent policy. There are a number of methods that can be sent, but typically that would be a document that the responding source could actually go get and hold in their system to have that patient consent on file in order to make an appropriate release. I think the only other piece I would call out on this slide, just because of some of the previous questions, is again just highlighting the QHINs are, you know, these super nodes that are managing the connectivity in the middle. Participants and sub-participants could really be any types of organizations that meet the definitions to participate, including individuals themselves through individual access services. So I think it was one of the previous questions about, you know, the role of HIEs. And Marianne touched on this a little bit in the overview, but an HIE There may be some HIEs where it's appropriate for them to become a QHIN, and they may desire that functionality. Others could be a participant within a QHIN, or even potentially a sub-participant. Really, at the participant and sub-participant level, the difference is just who they have a relationship with, whether that's directly with the QHIN or if they are below a participant of a QHIN. So for a provider organization, there will certainly be some provider organizations that are participants directly underneath a QHIN. There will be others that are sub-participants beneath a participant of a QHIN. But it shouldn't really make much of a difference as far as any sort of technical requirements or what they have access to. That's more just contractual of how far down the chain it is to their connection back up to the QHIN. Let's jump to the next slide, and I was just looking to see if any additional questions have come in. I think this is the last major slide here, is just the discussion on FHIR. Again, all of the current proposed exchanges are using IHE profiles. We acknowledge that FHIR is important, that organizations are supporting FHIR. There are requirements, such as in certification requirements and others, that are requiring MOVE for support of FHIR. However, there are a number of concerns currently with how FHIR would work in this QHIN to QHIN exchange model. Handling security with this multi-hop exchange, OAuth in this multi-hop exchange, that's not really how it's designed, routing of RESTful transactions over multi-hop. There are certainly some things that are going on in the industry with FAST and others that are addressing some of these concerns. And so the plan is that with the final version, released version, Q1 2022 of the QTF, we will also be releasing a FHIR roadmap showing the plan for getting to the inclusion of FHIR-based exchange in this framework. We are definitely looking for feedback on that from all of you. We've received some great feedback already in some of the QTF comments and feedback that we received, and expect that there will probably be additional work collecting feedback and working with the industry as we plan out how to eventually get to the inclusion of FHIR within this ecosystem. Slide, please. And I believe that is it. And Marianne, I think we're back over to you.
Thank you very much. I think at this point, we wanted to highlight how we are collecting feedback. So if you go to the next slide, I'll cover that in a little bit more detail. So we have a webinar series that for the sessions that have already taken place, you'll find the materials and the recordings posted. The next one is taking place tomorrow, where we're going to go through a deep dive of the QHIN designation and eligibility criteria. This is really important, and we really want to make sure that stakeholders both understand it and then provide input. We will be collecting input on our website until October 21st. You can see there's a form there. It's a lot easier for us if people use the form to submit the comments, but we will collect them through our email as well, if that's preferred. But it's helpful for us because it puts it in structured format. And then all feedback that is submitted to us will be publicly available. So just make sure there's not confidential information included in that. And then I know that some folks had asked if they could submit feedback after October 21st. We will continuously collect feedback. I think we've said numerous times, these are living documents. If we're going to learn, they're going to morph. And, you know, we really need to get this initial version out there so we can get this program launched, get things started, so we can get the governance process structured, and of course, all the other opportunities for input. So if you're not able to provide feedback before October 21st, don't worry. I mean, still submit it. We still process and assimilate everything. So next, I think with that, we're opening it up for further comments and discussions.
All right. So we do have some questions. I know there were a few questions in the chat. And we'll start with Arian, though. He has his hand up. And thank you very much, Marianne and Alan.
Hey, thanks to all the presenters, Marianne, Alan, Stephen. One question, and then I'll just make an editorial comment on soap versus fire, just to lead us off. This has been sort of an ongoing industry, sort of island, healthcare industry island issue where many of the standards we use for information exchange are from a technology perspective. And you just look at what is standard in technology are a little bit off in a legacy island. And it's down to things like what programming language can I use, or can I use .NET Core as opposed to that has simplified operations in a cloud environment versus having to use the full legacy .NET stack. And it's because the SOAP specs and the WS Star specs are used in environments in industry that are legacy environments. And so you pull them out when you need them, but they're not generally batteries included with the programming languages of our choosing. So my plea would be to quickly work through the technology issues relating to using OAuth transactions in multi-hop environments. There's nothing inherent in REST technology or inherent in OAuth or JOTS or anything like that that makes them inapplicable to multi-hop. So it's just sort of implausible that that's a hard a blocking issue. It is plausible that we need some work and we need to put together some profiles and do some testing. So completely acknowledge that, but it just would encourage participants to put a more aggressive timeline for healthcare to join the rest of technology. That's the editorial comment. So the question is, I'm a little lost on the record locator service flow when the receiving QHIN does not have the ability to respond with a record locator and multicast in their network. Whose responsibility is it to assemble the resulting information? I was good with you in the description all the way to the end, where it seemed like the requesting QHIN had the obligation to assemble all the information back into a combined query response. My perspective is that it really should be the receiving QHIN's obligation to solve for its local deployment model, figure out how to query all of its sub-participants, and then respond back with a singular query response that's inclusive of all of its member organizations. So I wonder if you could address that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a great question. And the answer is it depends on the flow and who is being queried. So the initiating QHIN, if they're only sending a query to one other QHIN, that one other QHIN, again, depending on how targeted the query is, may be responding back with a patient identifier for one of its participants or sub-participants, in which case no aggregation of responses is even needed. It just passes straight back through. If the responding QHIN is doing a lookup of all of its participants, sub-participants, and finds multiple of its own participants, sub-participants who know the patient, then the responding QHIN would need to aggregate all of those into a single response back to the initiating QHIN.
Perfect.
And then
Thank
in
you.
That case, it would still be a single response down. However, if the initiating QHIN is from a single query of its participant querying multiple QHINs and multiple outside QHINs know the patient, then the initiating QHIN is receiving multiple responses that it would aggregate back into a single response down to its participant.
Gotcha. That makes total sense. Thank you for that clarification.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Arian. Jim, I know you had a question in the chat. Did you want to ask your question?
Oh, yeah. It was about the the requester's requirement to I understand that information carried in that message includes reason, one of the six covered reasons, and other information about the specific request. That'll all be spelled out. Is that correct? And if we're a recipient, let's say, and someone, there's a requester that works through the QHINs, is it us just taking it on faith that they're good actors and that somebody claiming to have an operations or treatment reason actually does? I mean, how is it enforced if there are bad actors who are connecting and requesting information, claiming to be one of the six, approved uses, but we, the recipients, have no way of actually vetting that?
I think there are a couple of pieces to that question, and Steve or Marianne may want to jump in on that one as well as far as some of the enforcement. But I guess the first part of the question is that yes, it largely is trust. These are contractual terms. As Steve explained previously, there are specific requirements from the common agreement that are clearly called out as being flow-down terms to participants and sub-participants, including the appropriate use of exchange purposes. And so when a query comes through, the responding side is able to trust, because it has agreed to the same terms as everyone else, that this is a legitimate querying organization and the purpose being asserted is legitimate for the request. They can then use that information to make a determination of response, again, trusting the outside source of the request, without necessarily otherwise having any relationship with or knowing anything about the source of the request. Now, as far as non-compliance or issues, there is a governing body that would be overseeing some of that. There is a dispute resolution process that is defined for handling issues that do arise, but it is largely based on trust in the shared common agreement and the terms that have flowed down.
And is that something that... will it be fines or termination or legal action if there is someone found to be in violation? Or is that not yet?
This is Marianne. So, well, there the consequences would be facilitated. The process would be facilitated through a dispute resolution process, and there would be a panel that would hear, oversee, and address the matter, and then the repercussions, if it's not resolved, is suspension or termination. Steve, anything else you want to add in terms of enforcement?
Nope, that's good.
And obviously, if there was misuse of it, the OIG might be involved, I'm guessing. I just had one other quick question, and that is OAuth, too. We heard in the news, for example, that Health Gorilla is now announcing they're connecting to eHealth Exchange. And I'm just curious, with the networks, if these third-party app developers with Fire, RESTful APIs, and OAuth 2, will they be able to connect to QHINs? And if so, am I reading by your deck that you're still trying to figure out the OAuth 2 piece in the multiple hop situation?
So maybe
the OAuth 2 piece, go ahead, Marianne.
I was just going to address the business side first, and then if you want to address the OAuth, or do you want to just talk about OAuth first? I was just going to mention the other part of it.
I was just going to say the OAuth piece, again, would primarily come in with eventual move to or addition of Fire-based exchange. If an individual participant of a QHIN is using Fire-based exchange for their connectivity to the QHIN, that would be perfectly acceptable in this initial version, as long as the QHIN is able to handle that incoming information and translate it into the appropriate IAG profile with the required SAML information.
So my understanding of OAuth 2, and tell me if I'm being remedial here, is that there's an authentication with the application, but then there's also an authentication with the source, right? How does that work when a third-party app may be trying to get information on behalf of a patient from an HCA or a Vanderbilt? Because they really aren't able to really authenticate. Or will the exchange facilitate that authentication to the source system?
That there would not be an authentication all the way through to the source system today. Again, that's the piece that would require a multi-hop of the OAuth flow through the QHINs and would come. It is one of the considerations that we need to determine how to appropriately handle with the fire roadmap. The initial phase would require the sending of the SAML assertion in an IHE profile. It would not be using an OAuth authentication flow in the initial phase. That certainly could be used within a QHIN, but you wouldn't be able to authenticate all the way to the participant of another QHIN today.
So if a health gorilla, for example, had Firebase capabilities and was wanting to connect through a QHIN, in fact, they would be able to do so without the patient having to do the second step of OAuth 2 in the initial iteration.
Yeah, so an organization like Health Gorilla or others that have, you know, they use Fire as the method to connect to their gateway, they could continue to use whatever method they want, whether they were to become a QHIN themselves or to connect to another QHIN as a participant, and they would just need to handle appropriate translation, which, again, many of these networks already do today when they're exchanging through, you know, Carry Quality or Health Exchange, Commonwealth, et cetera. Handling whatever method of connectivity comes from their customers and translating it to the appropriate standard for the network they're exchanging across.
Thank you.
All right. I don't see any other hands up from committee members. Are there other questions? No. So if there aren't any other questions on the QHIN technical framework, how about any questions in general about the entire presentation from Mary Ann, Stephen, and Alan?
While the high-tech members are considering that, I just want to, again, give major credit to Mary Ann and team and larger team for the great work. This is not easy stuff, but wow, great job.
It doesn't look like we have any other questions, so I might ask, go and see if we're able to go to public comment early, and while we're looking at that, are there any final words that you all have, Mary Ann, Steve, and Alan, that you want to share with the committee?
Well, certainly, and I'll start and just say thank you all so much for your kind words of support and for the very thoughtful questions and comments, and we just really welcome the opportunity to hear from you and certainly open to any other feedback.
Well, thank you, and we appreciate all the work that you have done and the great stakeholder engagement that has occurred over the several months now. It's been excellent. All right. Mike, can we go to public comment?
Yes, we can. Operator, can we open up the line for public comments?
Yes. If you would like to make a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your line from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up the handset before pressing the star keys. One moment while we pull for comments.
And while we're waiting, I just want to remind everyone that our next HITAC meeting will be held on November 10th. And if anyone still needs today's presentation materials, they can be found on our website at healthit.gov. Operator, do we have any public comments?
There are no comments at this time.
All right, thank you. Please, Aaron.
All right. Any other feedback from the committee? I'm sure everybody would love to have time back in their schedule.
Looks like Dr. Lane has a question.
Yeah, I just I wasn't able to follow kind of all the chat that Dr. Waugh was offering about another topic. I just didn't know if, since we have a little time, Maybe we could give Robert the floor so he could provide the update he was trying to provide there.
And I apologize. I was moderating. I was not reading the chat as vigorous.
Exactly, right. I think a lot of us were focused on the presentation.
I think most of us were following the topic today, so we didn't see that.
Yeah. Let's clear the topic first. Let's just make one more time, I would say, Denise, one more pass at the committee, since we have Marianne and team here, just to give floor to our guests if they have any. Okay, I don't see any other hands raised.
All right, doesn't look like, and nothing on public comment.
Yeah, okay. No comments, all right.
So this is Robert. I don't know if you want to use
Yeah,
this
Robert.
I don't mean to jump in, but it's fine.
No, that's fine. If you would just keep it quick and brief, I'd appreciate that. Let's get this going.
Absolutely, and I appreciate the opportunity. And Steve, thanks for highlighting this. Just to give the HITACH an update on what's happening with smart health cards, I think it is pertinent to our discussions about data interoperability and how we can move health data more efficiently. I've talked about this many times in my role as chair of the Commons Project and also as a member of the Vaccine Credential Initiative, VCI. But, you know, almost 150 million citizens now have access to getting a smart health card to demonstrate and contain their vaccine status. And, you know, it's now many states are allowing access directly to their state IISs with this. Health systems are using their EHR platform, like Cerner and Athena Health, to create and issue smart health cards, and all major pharmacies are as well. So I just wanted to update the group on that and also alert them to a event that we're going to be hosting on October 28th. We're calling it the Global Forum, and we already have Secretary Leavitt and Andy Slavitt lined up as speakers for that. It'll be 10 a.m. to noon Eastern time on October 28th. The link for that registration will be live tomorrow on vci.org. But I just thought it's good for the committee to know about this, and I've talked about the fact that beyond the vaccination use case, smart health cards are secure digital envelopes that healthcare information can be put in that is privacy protecting, individually controlled, and non-tamperable. So we could think about other use cases besides the vaccination credential that I think is pretty exciting for the use of smart health cards. But the entire ecosystem has been built. So we've informed issuers how to issue them. The Commons Project created a verifier app that's free in the App Store, so you can scan the QR code that comes out of a smart health card. We've also created the Common Trust Network, which is a registry of trusted issuers, because without a registry of trusted issuers, obviously the whole system doesn't work. So we've tried to create the entire ecosystem to make these smart health cards work in the current environment. And as we see more mandates for vaccination status to be demonstrated, whether it be going into a bar or an employment back to work, we think all of these are going to drive demand for a non-tamperable, privacy-protecting, individually controlled way to demonstrate your vaccine status. So that's a summary quickly, as fast as I can do it, I think. But thanks for the opportunity.
Wonderful, Robert. Thank you. Appreciate it, Dr. Wall. Okay. All right. I think that is it. That did give folks also a chance to further marinate. If they have any more questions for Marianne and team, I don't see that. So Denise, I guess if everybody's in agreement, should we say our final parting words?
Yes. Thank you again to our presenters from the RCE. We really appreciate your time and excellent presentations. And now we all have a lot of things to think about and give you potential feedback through your public feedback forum. So thank you so much. And I wish our entire committee and our ONC team a good rest of their day.
Absolutely. And so I echo that. Thank you. Thank you again to Marianne, to Dr. Tripathi, and the whole ONC team for great work. I would say that I'm looking in with a provider lens, TESCA cannot come soon enough to whatever that materializes, but with great respect and kudos, echoing what John Canty said and others, that we have a phenomenal existing HIE infrastructure in the country. So seeing that work, together symbiotically and work together with the TESCA construct will be critical. And look forward to seeing that and really making patient information flow. So with that, have a great afternoon. Be safe, please. And take care.
Take care, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.